All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. And it's nice and loud. Maybe I'll turn it down just a little bit. And the date is November 10th. It's Wednesday. That means that we have our fourth exam a week from today on Wednesday. All right, so we got our fourth exam. And what we're covering today is not going to be on the exam. The exam is postponed a little bit because of all the lab practicums. But I didn't want to have a lecture exam and a lab practicum on the same day, so I put the lecture exams off. So make sure that you know chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 19 are on exam 4, which are what? Central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, autonomic nervous system, special senses, and heart are on the test, on the lecture exam. All right, so everybody's aware of that. So next Wednesday. And what does that mean? Thanksgiving is the week after. All right, that's neither here nor there. Okay. All right, so we were talking about blood vessels or circulatory system last time. And there's just a couple basic things that you should recall before we press on today. And that is, what are the two circulations in the body? Pulmonary and systemic, or you could say systemic and pulmonary. Right, that really doesn't matter to me, and you should know how that hooks up to the heart. Which side of the heart pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation? The right side, yeah, and then the left side of the heart pumps blood through the systemic circulation. Okay, what else do we want to know about the circulation? Some ground points. What the heck is an artery? Carries blood away from the heart, and you should know some arteries that carry oxygenated blood. Like, give me an example. Aorta, give me an example of an artery that carries deoxygenated blood. Pulmonary trunk, pulmonary arteries, exactly right. Right, and the same thing for veins. What's the definition of a vein? It carries blood back to the heart. You should know some veins that carry oxygenated versus deoxygenated blood. So we don't use that as a criteria for determining what a vein is. All right, and let's just think about blood vessels now. There are three main kinds. What are the three main kinds of blood vessels, and what are their functions? We kind of covered the functions of two of them already. There are arteries that carry blood away from the heart. There are veins that carry blood through the heart. That's the names and their functions. And what's the third kind? Capillaries, and what are they specialized for? Exchange, right? And that is due, according to our slide that we see right up here. Let me turn some of these lights down. That's a good one to turn down. That's a good one to turn down. Right, it just is determined by the number of layers. Capillaries are very thin, so that allows for exchange. Diffusion occurs through only very small distances. Diffusion cannot happen through a very thick kind of organ like a vein, or even a thicker organ like an artery. Right, so exchange only happens in the capillary. Furthermore, you should realize that there's not just one kind of capillary. There are three kinds of capillaries, based on their permeability, which means that their structure is different, right? Which is the one that is least leaky? What's the name of that one? That's a continuous capillary, right? And the leakiest is called the sinusoid, right? Some books actually call that a discontinuous capillary, and then the one that's intermediate is the fenestrated. So you have good pictures in your textbook of those three kinds of capillaries, but remember, they're still specialized for exchange. All right, so where were we last time? We're about ready to start the pulmonary circulation. All right, and I guess we were talking about how blood flows from one place to another. It's based on a pressure gradient. So how is blood going to flow? From what kind of pressure to what kind of pressure? From high pressure to low pressure. That's right. So, for instance, if you're squeezing down on a balloon, what's happening to the pressure inside that balloon? You're squeezing down on it. What happens to the pressure? Does it go up or down or stay the same when you start to squeeze on it? Yeah, it goes up. So if all of a sudden you put a hole in the balloon, which way is air going to go? Is it going to go in the balloon or out? It's going to go out because it's high pressure, right? So fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure, and veins have very low pressure. And we have to be concerned, how does blood that's in a vein that's very low pressure get back to the heart? And there are two mechanisms by which you should realize blood will find its way back to the heart. And it's called the respiratory pump and the skeletal muscle pump. And I think we were talking about those last time. Okay. For instance, when a skeletal muscle, let's see, how do I get the cursor over here? Just like this. All right, so let's consider a vein. How do you know this is a vein right here? Because you see valves, right? And so when these muscles contract, they bulge, and it compresses this segment of a vein. So it develops a really high pressure for a vein, and it's going to try to squirt from high pressure to low, which is inferior to it, or from high pressure to low pressure, which is superior to it, but blood will only move in one direction, and that's back toward the heart because of these valves right here. All right, so this is what we call the skeletal muscle pump that you have in all places of your body that are going to help venous return back to the heart. The other is the respiratory pump. All right, there are changes in pressure in your thorax, and you're aware of that. All right, so air is a fluid as well. Air flows into your lungs. Why does air flow into your lungs? Well, okay, the rationale is so that your body has oxygen, but I want to know the physics of it. Why does air flow in? Air flows because of a pressure gradient. Because of a pressure gradient, air will flow from high pressure to low, just like blood. So if air is flowing in your lungs, where is low pressure? Inside your lungs. Otherwise, the air wouldn't flow in there, and it's high around the atmosphere. All right, so as you expand your rib cage, the pressure decreases in your thoracic cavity. Air flows into your lungs, but there's another fluid that will flow into your thoracic cavity as well as the pressure decreases, and that is blood, right? Venous blood will flow into the thoracic cavity. It's being sucked into the thoracic cavity just like air is being sucked into your lungs. And then when you breathe out, right, you compress your thoracic cavity, that pressurizes the air in your lungs, and it goes from high pressure in your lungs to low pressure that's in the atmosphere, so air leaves. All right, but now what about blood, venous blood that got drawn into your thoracic cavity when you compress your thoracic cavity? Does it leave your thoracic cavity? Why can't it leave? Because there are valves right here, right? So that's a nice respiratory pump which helps venous return as well. All right, so now let's focus on some gross anatomy of the circulatory system, and we're going to cover the pulmonary circulation first. And I think you're pretty much aware of this one already, right, because we had to look at it for the heart. But where's the pulmonary circulation? Here's probably a pretty good diagram of the pulmonary circulation. All right, right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk. That's the most anterior great vessel on the heart. That's the first one you run into. Nonetheless, it's an artery, which means it's what? Very thick, has a lot of connective tissue, so that relatively high pressure doesn't dissect it or blow it apart. So it looks like the aorta, but it's not, right? It's anterior to the aorta. As it moves posterior to the arch of the aorta, it bifurcates into the left pulmonary artery, and it's nicely color-coded blue, signifying that it is what? Low in oxygen, even though it's an artery, right? And then that artery bifurcates into different lobar arteries going to different lobes of the lung, right? And then they bifurcate again, going to different segments of the lungs. I don't think you have to know any of those. What do you have to know? You've got to know right and left pulmonary artery and whether it's high in oxygen or CO2, all right? But there's another blood vessel that you should be aware of, right, between the pulmonary artery and pulmonary vein, and it's a special one. It is specialized because it allows for exchange, right? So carbon dioxide that's in the blood can exchange with little air pockets that are inside the lung that we call alveoli. So then your body is excreting CO2, and when you inhale, it brings in oxygen, so now you have a high concentration gradient, high oxygen in the alveolus, low in the blood, so oxygen is going to diffuse into the blood, and then your circulatory system will carry it all over your body. All right, so remember, these molecules will move by a concentration gradient only from high to low. So oxygen is going to be delivered to your tissues, right? Mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. So where is oxygen at a low concentration? Where is oxygen going to go? Is it low in the atmosphere, or is it low at the mitochondria? Is it low in the air or low in the mitochondria? It's going to be low. It's a strange concept, but actually the oxygen concentration is low inside your body, right? It's high in the atmosphere, and if it weren't the case, then oxygen would never enter your body if it wasn't just that way, right? You're really fixing on the concept that we need oxygen, and indeed we do, but it's low inside your body so that oxygen from the atmosphere goes in, okay? The same concept for CO2. CO2 is going to move according to a concentration gradient. Where is CO2 at a low concentration? Inside your body or in the atmosphere? It's low in the atmosphere. Otherwise, it would never leave your body and it would become toxic, right? So if CO2 is high inside your tissues, low in the air, so CO2 will diffuse from your body into the atmosphere. As a matter of fact, it's really pretty close to zero in the air, okay? Relatively high. So there's a huge concentration gradient. CO2 has a very easy job leaving your body because of that big concentration gradient. So this is the pulmonary circuit that you have to know, right? Starting with the pulmonary trunk, the two pulmonary arteries feeding these capillaries for exchange, right? And then when this blood picks up oxygen, it returns to the left atrium via the four pulmonary veins, which are nicely color-coded red. So that's the whole pulmonary circulation that you have to know. But it can be tricky, correct? Because arteries, compared to the systemic circulation, are what? In terms of function, are opposite each other. Okay. All right, so that takes us to the systemic circulation, which carries blood everywhere else in the body. All right, so where does the systemic circulation start? This is probably a pretty good figure to see systemic circulation. Okay, so here we have the aorta, which is taking most of the blood away from the left side of the heart. Namely, left ventricle is pumping into the aorta. This first division here is the ascending aorta. There are some branches off the ascending aorta that I don't want you to forget about. And they're part of the systemic circuit because the heart needs blood itself, right? And this is kind of a review from last chapter. There are two branches off the ascending aorta. They're the right coronary and the left coronary, and you had to know the coronary circulation for the heart. So this left coronary bifurcates into the circumflex and this left anterior descending, and you maybe had to know a couple other arteries on the heart and some veins as well on the posterior side. All right, so here we have ascending aorta. Then we have the arch. I was thinking about what I wanted to say next. Here's the arch. Right, so it makes a 180-degree turn, and there are a couple branches off the arch of the aorta. This first one is the brachiocephalic. That means it goes brachium, it goes to the arm, as well as cephalic up toward the head. The artery that takes blood to the head is the common carotid. The artery that takes blood to the arm, as a matter of fact, what arm is this over here? Right arm, right? It goes right underneath the clavicle, so that's called the subclavian artery. Okay, this common carotid, you see, bifurcates kind of by your mandible right here into an external carotid and an internal carotid. The external takes blood to the superficial structures on your head outside the cranial vault, and the internal carotid takes blood to your brain, all right, in the cranial vault. And right here, this is a very important part of the carotid artery system. This is called the carotid sinus. Right at this bifurcation, there's a little bit of a swelling called the carotid sinus, and there are special sensors here for monitoring blood pressure. And so these little sensors here help regulate blood pressure all over your body. So that's a very important point. The other thing about the carotid sinus is that it's prone to disease. It's prone to dissecting, which means it splits apart, which is not a good thing. You don't have any blood vessels splitting apart. And it also forms a lot of plaques that impede blood flow to your brain, which is a terrible thing, especially during what time? During a test. Because what does your brain need during a test? A lot of oxygen, right? Okay, so that carotid sinus clinically is very important. It's probably the most imaged part of anybody's body in a hospital all day long. People are getting ultrasounds of this carotid sinus right here, looking for disease, plaques, dissections, other kinds of abnormalities right here. All right, the other branches off the aorta, arch of the aorta, so that's brachiocephalic. We've got the left common carotid, and that's going to do the job of the right common carotid, and then the left subclavian, which does the job of the right subclavian, which come from the brachiocephalic. So how many brachiocephalic arteries do you have in your body? You only got one, okay? So there's a strange asymmetry right there because there is no left brachiocephalic because you have a left common carotid and a left subclavian coming off the arch of the aorta. And then you have this long segment of aorta, which is called the descending aorta, that goes all the way down to this bifurcation right here. And there are two important divisions of the descending aorta. Within the thoracic cavity, that's called the thoracic aorta, between the arch and the diaphragm. And then it passes through the diaphragm down to this bifurcation right here. This would be the abdominal aorta. And it's just a division of the descending aorta. All right, so then that takes us down to this lower extremity. All right, after this bifurcation, we got the iliac arteries. And they're going to go to the right and left sides of the body. And then soon after that, there's a bifurcation to the external iliac and the internal iliac. Right, so the internal iliac is going to bring blood to pelvic organs, and the external will take it to the extremity, the lower appendages, where you find, right, like the femoral artery, okay, going up over here. We don't see some of the arteries. Maybe I got some other pictures of other arteries. What do I want you to know for these arteries? I have to click lower limbs. I just want you to know femoral and popliteal. Where would you look for popliteal? Yeah, behind the knee, right? It's the posterior knee, so kind of in the bend of your knee. So you've got, sorry, these cursors are a little funny. So you got femoral and then popliteal in this region. And I'm not asking you to label any of these down here in the leg. So that's pretty good for the lower appendage. The upper appendage, we can look at these. You got the subclavian, and then the name changes as you get into the axillary region, right? And then the name changes once again once you get into the brachium. And so that's called the axillary artery and then the brachial artery. And then you can see the brachial bifurcating. Okay, which ones do I want you to know for that? Axillary, brachial, then ulnar and radial artery, which you can see very nicely on this diagram right here. So here's the radial and here's the ulnar artery. So that's all you have to know as far as tracing these arteries. Now, the questions in the back of the book, right, are a little bit more, at the end of the chapter, are a little bit difficult. All right, it's easy to label this diagram, and indeed you might have a diagram like this on the test, but I might include some of the questions at the end of the chapter which list a bunch of blood vessels, and then it asks you which one is missing from that list. So it might say ascending aorta, brachiocephalic, subclavian, brachial, and radial artery. So in that course of blood, which one did I omit from my list? Okay? I said what? Ascending, brachiocephalic, subclavian, brachial, and then radial artery. Which one did I forget to mention? Ah, the axillary right here. All right, so when you work those questions, make sure you have a picture in your mind of this circulatory system. And on the test, what can you do? You can use a picture that I'm trying to test you on as a key for answering those other questions, right? Because you should be able to label all of these different segments of these arteries. Okay, so arteries will change name even though it's the same vessel depending on what region of the body that it's in. And that shouldn't be a surprise to you because, right, you're familiar with that. That's what we do with streets all the time, right? We change the names of streets depending on what city it's in. Like if you hop on Lincoln and you go west, what does Lincoln turn into? Carson Street, right? And a lot of streets around here do that. And you just got to be familiar with the names of streets. Okay. All right, so that's the upper and lower appendage. We do want to look at the divisions off the abdominal aorta. All right, I'm not going to ask you much in the way of branches coming off the thoracic aorta, but you should just be aware that there are visceral arteries going to organs in the thorax. right? And then there are parietal arteries that go to the musculature and skin in the chest wall. Right, but I don't think I have any of those on an exam diagram. All right, but let's look at the abdominal arteries. Those are maybe a little bit more confusing, but I think once you see how they're labeled, it's not too bad. Okay, four abdominal arteries, like we have right here. This is good. Okay, so here we have descending aorta from the diaphragm down to the bifurcation of the iliacs. What division of the aorta is this? Abdominal aorta, right? Descending. And if you look, you'll see that the branches coming off the aorta are one of two different kinds. In some parts of your body, you have two organs, okay? And in other parts of your body, you only got one organ. Right, and so you're familiar with a lot of bilateral symmetry. If we look right here, we see that you have a right and left kidney. So you have two kidneys. So guess what? You have a right and left renal artery. So we say that these arteries come off the aorta as a paired branch, right? The right and left renal arteries. Other kinds of organs you only have one of. What kind of organ do you only have one of? I know you're not really, well, you haven't passed anatomy yet, but you're close to passing it. And we haven't really talked about all the organs in the abdominal cavity, but you should be aware that in this abdominal cavity, some organs you only have one copy of. You don't have a right and left. Like, give me an example. Pancreas, liver, stomach, right? A lot of organs you only have one copy of and not two. You don't have a right and a left. So, guess what? You don't need paired branches of arteries to go to one organ. You just need one artery. So the arteries that feed organs or supply blood to organs that you only have one of, we call those unpaired branches. So think of arteries coming off the descending aorta as either being an unpaired branch, like this superior mesenteric, or a paired branch like the renal arteries right here because you have two kidneys. All right, so let's go over the unpaired branches first. This first one, right underneath the diaphragm, all right, this is the celiac trunk. Just like the pulmonary trunk, it's going to bifurcate a bunch into a bunch of different arteries. All right, it's going to go to organs that you only have one of, like the liver. That's going to form the hepatic artery is going to come off the celiac trunk. There's going to be a splenic artery that goes to the spleen. There's going to be a gastric artery that goes to the stomach. So what I want you to know, this first artery off the abdominal aorta is the celiac trunk, and it's an unpaired branch. The next one, distal to it, this is the superior mesenteric. This is going to take blood to the parts of the large intestine and small intestine. And then the last unpaired branch is the inferior mesenteric. Right, so the only difficult thing about this is trying to remember the name of this first unpaired branch, which is the celiac trunk. Right, and then you got the mesenterics, and then superior, of course, makes sense, and inferior mesenteric right here makes perfect sense as well. So those are the only unpaired branches that you have to know. So that leaves the paired branches. And I see arteries going to the adrenal gland. Sometimes we call these the suprarenal glands. Actually, it's fairly uncommon that we call them that. But we call these the suprarenal arteries or adrenal arteries. And you got two adrenal glands, so you got a left and a right. You got a left and a right renal artery going to the kidneys. And these are huge compared to the unpaired branches going to the adrenal gland because the kidneys need a lot of blood to stay alive. They require about 20% of blood flow that's flowing through your body at any one time. Even though these things are small, they're only about as big as your fist, they require 20% of all blood that's flowing in your body. That's a huge demand. All right, so that's why the renal arteries are big. The other branches, paired branches, will be the gonadal arteries right here, going to the gonads. Give me some examples of gonads. Ovaries. What else? Testes, right? Okay, because usually you have two copies of those as well. Not guaranteed in all cases, but usually that's what happens. Okay, so here you have the gonadal arteries that go to the ovaries and the pelvic cavity or all the way down to the testes and the scrotum, right, if it's a male. So that's it for branches off the aorta. Not terribly complicated, right? So simplified in terms of unpaired branches versus paired branches and then it's pretty easy to figure it out. Question. There was a question somewhere. I forget where it went. It went away. Okay, good. I don't like questions. No, I'm just kidding. That's okay. All right, so that's the abdominal aorta. And you know what? I think we talked about the lower appendage. So we're done talking about the aorta. But I want to talk a little bit about the brain. Where is that at? Right up over here. In this region right here. Let me show you a picture. How do I get back? Okay, here is a pretty good diagram. So now instead of just a frontal view of the arterial system, we're looking at a lateral view. And what do we got right here? It's not labeled. Ooh, trick question. What is this right here? That looks like the arch of the aorta. Yeah, very good. So this is the aorta right here. And what's that first branch off the aorta called? Brachiocephalic trunk, and indeed it's labeled that. And don't forget that bifurcates very early on into the common carotid. As a matter of fact, it's going to be the right common carotid. Here's the right subclavian. All right, and that's going to go to the arm, and you know what happens right there. Right after that bifurcation between the common carotid and the subclavian, we have another branch off the subclavian, which is this one right here. Right, and that is the vertebral artery. And look where it goes. This is a blast from the past. Right, it goes through the transverse processes of all those cervical vertebrae right there that you had to know at one point in time. All right, so the vertebral artery and the internal carotid that I see right here are the only two blood vessels that bring blood to your brain. Only these two. There's two on the right, there's two on the left. So you can imagine that these blood vessels are very important, because I know what your favorite organ is in your body. Is your brain right here. And it needs a lot of blood, okay, via these two arteries. Okay, now what's going to happen if one of these vertebral arteries gets blocked? Something bad could happen, but you learn something about a nerve plexus. What's the job of a nerve plexus? It just allows different routes for important nerve signals to get to an important organ. So if one nerve is damaged, it can take an alternate route to get to that important organ. The brain is an important organ, and if one of these blood vessels is blocked, guess what? There is like a plexus at the base of the brain that receives blood from all of these blood vessels, and it can recirculate blood to any part in the brain from any of these four right here. All right, so let's go over just one more time this diagram. We have the common carotid, and it bifurcates into the external and internal. Internal accesses the cranial vault through the carotid canal, and right in this region you can see there's a swelling in this region, and you should know that's called the carotid sinus. So maybe label your textbook carotid sinus right here. It's right at the bifurcation. Okay. Carotid sinus. There's a nice angiogram. All right, so let's look at this view. And we see the two vertebral arteries, and it goes just to the ventral surface of the brainstem. The two vertebral arteries form a single blood vessel that we call the basilar artery. All right, and then it goes up very close to the mammillary bodies. Right, and this is where it joins that plexus. It's kind of like a roundabout there that we have in Long Beach. This blood can take any of these ways around at the base of the brain. All right, also contributing blood to this, what we call the circle of Willis, are the two internal carotid arteries. So the two vertebrals and the two carotids feed blood right to this circle of Willis right here. And so if one of these blood vessels is blocked, it doesn't mean that one side of the brain is going to be completely devoid of its circulation, which would be what? Immediately fatal, right? So there are ways for the circulation to compensate via the circle of Willis right here. And I don't think I'm asking you to know the names of these communicating arteries that make up the circle of Willis, but you should at least be aware that there is a circle of Willis right here that can shunt blood from one side of the brain to the other should one of these blood vessels become partially occluded. I don't think anybody's brain would function normally if, say, there was 100% occlusion of either the right or the left internal carotid because those are so important, but probably a 30 or 40% occlusion, you might not notice any pathology as well, any pathology whatsoever. Maybe a blockage of a vertebral, probably wouldn't notice any change, all right? But if there's major percentages of blockages in the carotids, that will still cause problems for people. Okay, so don't forget about the circle of Willis right there. And we've got the internal and the vertebral forming what? The circle of Willis via the basilar artery that the vertebral's anastomose to form. So I think, you know what? That's pretty much it for arteries. All right, so what is an anastomosis? That is where two blood vessels join together to form one. All right, so the two vertebrals anastomose to form the basilar artery right here. It's not too common that arteries do that, but it is very common that veins do that. All right, so as blood leaves the heart and it moves out to the periphery, usually there are bifurcations, and that leads to what? Smaller and smaller arteries. As blood returns to the heart via veins, veins join together to form what? Larger and larger veins at anastomoses. All right, so another question here is, what is the neuronal equivalent of a vascular anastomosis, at least on the arterial side? Would be a nerve plexus, right? All right, and what is the function of a vascular anastomosis? Like the circle of Willis right here, it just allows blood to take alternate routes, say like to get to the temporal bone. How could blood get to this temporal lobe right here? It could come up the right vertebral, could come up the left vertebral if the right is blocked. It could come up the right carotid or left carotid and take the circle of Willis to get to this side of the brain. So that's a handy feature to have. So I'm sure you can appreciate the evolutionary significance of that circle of Willis right there. Okay, veins. Let's talk about veins. And again, are veins high in CO2 or high in oxygen?
High in CO2.
I hear high in oxygen. I hear high in CO2. Well, it depends on what circulation you're talking about, right? So veins are high in CO2 if it's a systemic. It's high in oxygen if it's a pulmonary circulation. So you just have to know that. In most cases in the body, veins are named after the arteries that they course along with. So they usually flow right along, or you find them right along where the arteries are, except in a few locations of the body, which you have to be a little bit aware of. All right, so what do we call the big arteries in the neck that carry blood to the head, either the cranial vault or the external head? That is the common carotid, all right? And you don't have a common carotid vein. Instead, we call that the jugular vein, right? So there's no carotid vein, that's the jugular. You do have a vertebral vein, which makes sense. So here is the internal jugular vein. And the internal jugular vein joins up with the subclavian. All right, and what did we call that segment of vessels on the arterial side that gives way to the common carotid and the subclavian artery? That's the brachiocephalic, right? So brachium and head. So this right here is the brachiocephalic artery right here. I'm sorry, brachiocephalic vein. And unlike the artery, you actually have two brachiocephalic veins. You have one on the right side and you got one on the left side. And maybe I can show you a picture. So here is just a short segment of the right brachiocephalic vein. Right in this region, the left brachiocephalic vein joins, or anastomoses, forming the superior vena cava. What other veins are we interested in? Here's a good one. Let's zoom into this. All right, so we see the internal and external jugular joining the subclavian, forming a brachiocephalic division right here on the right side. Here's a brachiocephalic on the left side. And then they anastomose to form the superior vena cava. So you got two brachiocephalic veins. That's important for you to know. What else do I want you to know for veins? All right, I don't think I want to go over the ones that you looked at in lab. So I'm going to go and talk about some special circulations in your body. Okay? And a special circulation happens on the systemic side. I don't think there's anything. Oh, yes, there was something I wanted. I'll get back to that head in just a little bit. Okay. So what do you call a blood vessel that carries blood away from the heart? That's an artery. Then you got a blood vessel that carries it back. That's a vein. And what do you got between the two? Capillaries for exchange. And how many capillary beds do you have between an artery and a vein? Okay. You usually just have one. Right? Because as an artery, if it's on the systemic circulation, it's carrying oxygen to those capillaries, and then oxygen leaves the capillaries, and it's really got not much more oxygen to give up to another capillary someplace. But every once in a while in the body, all right, we actually do have two capillary beds back to back. So here is the arterial blood supply entering this little arteriole, passing through this precapillary sphincter to this first capillary bed. And what can happen here? Exchange. Things can enter or leave the circulatory system. And then all these capillaries, anastomose into venules, which form a vein. But now this vein does not take blood back to the heart. It takes it to a second capillary bed. This is a very strange circumstance, right, where exchange can take place again, and then these capillaries anastomose back into another vein, and that empties into the vena cava, which takes it back to the heart. So in this kind of circulation, which is called a portal system, you have two capillary beds back to back. And the usual circumstance is just one. So a portal circulation is a special delivery system which can pick up substances in one part of the body and deliver it directly to another part without mixing it and diluting it in what? The whole blood volume of the circulatory system. All right, so it stays confined to this portal system. This is important because, for instance, in the stomach and intestines, whenever you eat something, right, those substances will be absorbed into your circulatory system, and those substances could be beneficial things like nutrients, but they can also be toxins, which could be very toxic to your brain or other parts of your body. Right? So they enter the circulatory system, the toxins enter the circulatory system, and if it weren't for this portal system, where would they go? They would go everywhere in the body, right? Poisoning every place in the body. But since it's a portal circulation, they are trapped in the hepatic portal vein. Why can't they get out of the hepatic portal vein right here? It's too thick. They're delivered to the liver where there's another capillary. These capillaries in the liver are sinusoids, which are what? Specially leaky. They leak a lot of plasma, so the toxins leave the blood and are filtered by the liver cells, which can detoxify them, right? And then that fluid is resorbed at the distal end of the capillary and put in the systemic circulation, and now they're detoxified. And this segment of blood vessel between the capillaries in the intestines and capillaries in the liver, that's what we call the portal vein, and since it's going to the liver, we call it the hepatic portal vein. All right, so there are a couple places in the body, maybe three or four places that have this special portal circulation. All the rest is just typical. So if we look at the lecture notes over here, all right, we see the hepatic portal system. Around the gastrointestinal tract, we have capillaries in the stomach, small intestine, right? And then that blood drains back into the gastric vein. Guess what? That's where that's coming back from. Gastric refers to the stomach, okay? The superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric vein, and splenic vein all drain into the hepatic portal vein, which takes blood to the liver capillaries, where it's detoxified, all right? And then those capillaries anastomose to hepatic veins, which drains blood to the inferior vena cava, which takes it back to the right atrium, right here. So that's the complete hepatic portal system. And a couple of the other portal systems we find in the nephron of the kidney, which we're going to look at in one of the next chapters, and also between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, because the hypothalamus releases hormones that affect the pituitary gland, and we call that the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. So you have these three portal systems. And what's a nice, easy way of thinking of a portal system? It's a special delivery system. It's like a door-to-door delivery system so that these products don't have to mix with all the blood everywhere in your body. It goes from one specific location to another, like from the digestive tract to the liver for detoxification. All right. I do want to go back and look at some veins in the head. This might help people maybe a little bit on the practicum. All right, so brain tissue doesn't have a lot of veins, blood vessels going through it, okay, except in certain spaces, like right in the middle, right on top of the longitudinal fissure within the meninges. There's a superior sagittal sinus, which drains blood back from the superior parts of the cranium. The inferior sagittal sinus right here from the inferior parts of the cerebrum. Right, and then it flows into the straight sinus, and then right here we call this the confluence of the sinuses, which is the superior, inferior, and transverse sinuses, and then into the sigmoid sinus, and then finally into the internal jugular vein, which takes it back to a subclavian. Right, so these sinuses right here, I don't think you really want to think of them as blood vessels, but they're really part of the meninges, right? They're between the meningeal and ostial divisions of the dura mater. There's a separation, and these spaces carry the blood back to the jugular vein. I can't remember if this is an exam figure or not, but you can see the dura mater right here. Actually, this is called this membrane right here, that is in the longitudinal fissure, this is really the falx cerebri, and it's just a special part of the dura mater. Okay, the last part of the circulatory system, which I think you guys are pretty familiar with already, is the fetal circulation. All right, so let's just review that really fast. Fetal circulation is right here. Your book has some pretty nice new diagrams. All right, so there are five structures, right, not counting the placenta, that the fetus has that the adult circulation does not have. And the way that I want you to think about these is that this circulation is modified in the fetus because the fetus is not using some organs. Like, name two organs that the fetus really is not using and doesn't need to have blood going to. The lungs, right, because the fetus is not breathing air, there's no oxygen. Not a big reason for blood to go to the lungs. There's no oxygen to pick up there. And one important organ for detoxification, we said, was the liver, and the fetal liver is not developed yet either. So there's not a whole lot of reason for blood to go to the liver either. So what's doing the job of the lungs and the liver in the fetus? Yeah, it's the maternal, right? It's the mother's lungs and the mother's liver that's doing the job via the placenta. So the placenta is really doing the job of the lungs and the liver for the fetus. Okay. So now think of the adult pulmonary circulation. What's the adult pulmonary circulation like compared to the systemic circulation? What can you tell me about arteries in the adult pulmonary circulation? Is it high in oxygen?
No.
It's low because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen, so the blood going to the lungs is low. All right, so now, instead of thinking about adult lungs, think about the fetal placenta right here. Blood going to the placenta is going there to pick up what? Oxygen. So what about the blood going to the placenta? Should it be high in oxygen or low? Should be low in oxygen, right? So the umbilical arteries right here are low in oxygen. They're analogous to what? The pulmonary arteries. They're low in oxygen. They go to the placenta. And there are capillaries in the placenta. Exchange takes place. Oxygen goes in the blood. CO2 leaves. Right? And so now we have blood returning to the fetus via the umbilical vein, which is colored, nicely colored red right here, because why? It is oxygenated, right? So again, I want you to think of the pulmonary circulation. So these umbilical arteries turn into the medial umbilical ligaments in the adult, because the adult certainly doesn't have a placenta anymore as soon as you're born, right? And the umbilical vein becomes the ligamentum teres that you can actually see moving through the liver in the adult. Now we said that blood doesn't necessarily have to go to the liver. So let's alleviate the job of the fetus to do that, and let's put in a shunt that will take blood going to the liver and deliver it directly, bypassing the liver, into the inferior vena cava. And this right here is what we call the ductus venosus, right? Because it's a part of the vena system, even though it's oxygenated blood, it's taking it back to the vena cava, all right? And that becomes the ligamentum venosum in the adult. So how many structures is that? That's three structures. We got two more left to look at. All right, so that blood in the inferior vena cava goes back to the heart. Vena cava empties blood into the right atrium, okay, and then it's going to go into the right ventricle and then enter the pulmonary circulation, but there isn't much blood that has to go into the pulmonary circulation because the lungs really aren't performing a function for the fetus, right? So we want to take blood from the right side of the heart over to the left, from the pulmonary circulation to the systemic circulation, because it's oxygenated already. There are two ways to do that. There is a hole in the interatrial septum called the, what's a hole in anatomy again called? Foramen. Foramen, yeah. Fossa's close. It's close to hole. All right, but foramen is better. Foramen ovale, it's kind of like an oval-shaped hole between the right and left atria, so blood can flow directly from the right atrium into the left through the foramen ovale in what individual? The fetus right here, and it bypasses the pulmonary circulation. Some blood that doesn't get shunted to the left atria does get pumped into the right ventricle and into the pulmonary trunk, but there is another way to escape the pulmonary circulation, and that is through a blood vessel between the pulmonary trunk and the aorta, part of the arch of the aorta, and that's called the ductus arteriosus. So again, that takes blood from the pulmonary circulation and places it in what circulation? The aorta is what circulation? Systemic, yeah, and places it in the systemic circulation. All right, and then when an individual is born, that foramen ovale should heal over, should close. Okay, and then this ductus arteriosus, instead of becoming a patent blood vessel, turns into a ligament, which is the ligamentum arteriosum, which you can see nicely on most of our models in lab. Not all of them. Okay, but if these, if that foramen remains patent, which means open, if it transmits blood, if blood can move across the interatrial septum, eventually that has to be repaired. If it's a big hole, it has to be repaired really soon. Right, and the same thing for that ductus arteriosus. If it doesn't close off and turn into a ligament, then that has to be repaired as well, closed off. And for instance, if somebody is born, if this fetus is born with a patent foramen ovale or a patent ductus arteriosus, they don't have blood going to their lungs, and they're going to have a noticeable color difference compared to most newborn babies. What color are they going to look like? Yeah, because their blood is not being oxygenated. It's not going to the lungs, right? So in the surface of their skin where you have normally nice oxygenated blood that's red, okay, fingernails, eyes, earlobes, maybe their gums, right, around their teeth, they're going to have a bluish cast to them, and that's called cyanosis, which means that they have a cardiac problem or a pulmonary problem or a vascular problem, abnormality, and then it has to be diagnosed quickly and be repaired. Okay, so that's it for circulatory system, unless somebody has some questions. Any questions? Ah, okay, so the foramen ovale in the interatrial septum, when the fetus is born, turns into the fossa ovalis. It's still thin, so it feels like a depression if you were to pinch from one atria into a side into the other atrium. It would be a thin section, so it would be a little depression between the atria in the interatrial septum. That would be a fossa ovalis. And you can see that in most of our anatomical models as well. Okay, so that fetal model will be on a practicum, and maybe fossil valus is part of a practicum too. On what kind of heart would the fossil valus be found in? The adult heart. That's right, the adult heart. The adult normal heart. The adult heart still could have a foraminal valley, but that would be what? A pathological condition. Okay, we don't have any seriously pathological hearts in lab, I'm happy to say. All right, so any other questions? That's pretty much it. Okay, so it's just a matter of maybe memorizing your blood vessel order. Maybe just draw a stick diagram of blood vessels and where they bifurcate and label those diagrams. The portal system is a little bit different than other circulatory systems. And I think that's all I have to say about the circulatory system. Unless there's another question. That's it. The next test, a week from today. But circulatory system won't be on it. Okay, it's going to stop with what? I believe the heart. It's going to stop with the heart chapters.